One of the first styles that I remember learning, writing styles, one of the first writing styles I remember learning to write in elementary school was the how-to style. You guys ever heard to write like a how-to paper in school? Maybe you've taught that to some students. So when I was in like third or fourth grade, maybe earlier, we learned how to write how-to papers. And so what you had to do is you had to write the paper, and then you had to actually like present it to the class. So I had one classmate that wrote a how-to paper on how to play the piano. She came and showed up and played the piano for the whole class. It was incredible. Another one of my classmates did a how-to paper, I remember, on how to train your dog to do tricks. She brought her dog to class and showed her dog doing tricks. And I went back home and like I was trying to get my dog to do these tricks, but he was too old. And it was just not going to happen. I was a little disappointed in that. So it came for my turn. Let me just say, I wasn't on the same level as those other two and me and my other classmates. My how-to paper was on how to make a grilled cheese. And you just got to find the right passions in life, right? Like piano, dog, food. That's the passion. But it wasn't even like a good grilled cheese. My how-to paper was, take these two pieces of bread, put them in the toaster. We know this is not how you make your grilled cheese, right? Put the two pieces of bread in the toaster. When they pop out, while they're still hot, take them really quickly, put the piece of cheese in it, put the piece of bread together. And it's like the driest, nastiest grilled cheese ever. As you can tell, I benefited from LaGrange Elementary a lot more than I benefited LaGrange Elementary in my contributions as a student. But we are surrounded by this style of presentation, this how-to presentation. Again, maybe you're not looking up how to make a grilled cheese, but there's all kinds of YouTube videos on how to fix your car or how to fix something in your house. There's social media posts on how to have a great vacation or how to change this part of your life. There's articles on how to be a better parent. There's apps on how to get in shape or how to prepare for this race or anything like that. And what we do with these things is we take a question and or problem, and then we go usually to the internet to find the answer to that question or the solution to that problem. We have to find the right how-to that's going to address it. And the goal of any how-to video, article, presentation is to help you troubleshoot your life. You have a question, here's the answer. You have a problem, here's the solution. And I think there are times when we're disappointed that the Bible is not more like that. That I have this question and I just should be able to come and just immediately find the answer. Or I have this problem and I should be able to come and immediately just kind of type in and find the solution. There's times we want something different from the Bible than what God gives us in the Bible. And it'd be really helpful, we think, if we could just come to the Bible and find clear direction on what to do in a certain situation or how to handle a certain question. And I think one of the most common questions we would love to be able to do that with is, how are we supposed to worship God together? What's worship supposed to look like in a church? It would be really convenient and would have helped many churches over many years to avoid a lot of arguments and conflicts if there was just some clear direction in here. Here's the style you're supposed to have. Here's the instruments you're supposed to use. Here's how long your service is supposed to last. Here's what your worship room, sanctuary, whatever you call it, here's what you're supposed to call it. Here's what it's supposed to look like. But none of that's in the Bible. None of that's there. The next, as we continue to unpack these rhythms that we're honing in on as a church, rhythms that we want to be about in our own lives, but also together as a church, the next rhythm we're coming to is the rhythm of worshiping with His people. We've looked at hearing His voice through His word, having His ear through prayer, coming to His table at the Lord's Supper, and this rhythm of worshiping with His people. It's an irreplaceable rhythm in the life of a disciple of Jesus. But there are so many different opinions on how it's supposed to be done. And a lot of times, all the different opinions can cause the value of it in our minds to kind of diminish. Well, if there's so many different ways to do it, does it really matter that we do it to begin with? How we do it is an important question. But it's not the most important question. There's two above that question, two questions before we get to the how, and we'll certainly get to the how. But I want to answer all these questions today as we look together at Psalm 29. Turn with me to Psalm 29. We're going to look there together as we think about this rhythm, this habit of worshiping the Lord together with His people. And as we look at Psalm 29, we're going to be answering three questions that I think this psalm brings to the surface for us. And the three questions may sound basic and fundamental, but if we assume the answers to these questions, I think that's where we end up moving in the wrong direction. The three questions are this, and then I'm going to read Psalm 29 for us. The three questions are, who do we worship, why do we worship, and how do we worship? So who, why, and how. Psalm 29, I'll start in verse 1. King David writes this. Ascribe to the Lord, O heavenly beings. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due His name. Worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness. The voice of the Lord is over the waters. The God of glory thunders. The Lord over many waters. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is full of majesty. The voice of the Lord breaks the cedars. The Lord breaks the cedars of Lebanon. He makes Lebanon to skip like a calf, and Sirion like a young wild ox. The voice of the Lord flashes forth flames of fire. The voice of the Lord shakes the wilderness. The Lord shakes the wilderness of Kadesh. The voice of the Lord makes the deer give birth and strips the forest bare. And in His temple, all cry, glory. The Lord sits enthroned over the flood. The Lord sits enthroned as King forever. May the Lord give strength to His people. May the Lord bless His people with peace. As we move into answering the first question, it's who do we worship? Who do we worship? And like I said, that first question may seem overly basic. Surely we all know and agree on the answer to this question. We wouldn't even be in this room, right, if we had disagreements on what the answer was to that question. Who do we worship? Well, our mouths may all agree on the answer to this question, but I don't know that our hearts all agree on the answer to this question. Before this psalm speaks to what comes out of our mouths, and it will speak to that, it talks first about what's going on in our hearts. Look at verse 1. Ascribe to the Lord, O heavenly beings. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. David is calling the angels and beings in heaven to worship the Lord and proclaim His glory and strength. And they do that all the time. Unceasingly, they worship the Lord. And we're called into that same worship. And there's a command here. Ascribe to the Lord. Ascribe to Him glory and strength. Ascribe means to give, to attribute to. And this is going to bring us to a really clear definition of what worship is. Because this is the connection here between true worship and false worship. We are all ascribing glory and strength to something or someone. We are all giving glory and honor to something or someone, whether it's the Lord, ourselves, something or someone else. But the command here is to give glory and strength to the Lord. And the command to give these things to the Lord does not mean He's lacking in these things. David's not saying, hey, the Lord's a little low on glory and a little low on strength, so we all need to give Him glory and strength. No, to ascribe to the Lord glory and strength means to recognize His glory. It means to see His glory, to experience the power of His strength. And with this, we're getting closer and closer to a definition of what worship is and who we worship. You see it more clearly in verse 2. Look there with me. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due His name. Worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness. Verse 2 contains this feature that you see a lot in many of the Psalms. It's a feature known as parallelism, it's common in poetry, where the author will state a line and then will kind of rephrase it and say the same thing in a different way in the second line. You've seen this before in Psalms or in songs, things that even aren't connected to church. But he does that here in verse 2. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due His name. And then he rewords it, rephrases it. Worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness. I think the elements of true worship are found here in verse 2. This is what we are after as we gather together in worship. Because to give, to ascribe, that's something that we do with our hearts. That's something we do with our minds. That's something we do with our voices. But to worship or to bow down is what it means. That's something we do with our wills. So This is a whole person response in worship. This isn't just come and kind of audibly sing to the Lord or audibly proclaim His praises, but give your life in worship to Him. Let everything you are be about worshiping Him. As we sang earlier, oh, let all that is in me adore Him. Not just part of me, but all of me recognizing all of Him. To worship God means to give Him the honor His name deserves. That's what He says in verse 2. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due His name. To worship God means to bow down your life before His holy presence. It may be easy enough to sit in a room like this and me to throw out a question. Who do we worship? And for us to all just, God. Easy. Check that one off. Next question. Bring it on. Feeling pretty good about this. But who is that God? We can easily say, well, we're supposed to worship God. We worship God. But who is He? And not just who's your mental understanding of who He is, but who do you actually live as who He is? What does your life say about who He is? Because no, you might have picked up on this when I was reading, but the name Lord shows up 18 times in 11 verses in this song. It's over and over. Lord in all caps. Ascribe to the Lord. Ascribe to the Lord. Worship the Lord. The voice of the Lord. Over and over. This is not just some generic God that you just kind of pick or just some God that we don't fully understand. This is the God who formed the universe. This is the God who sought out a people to save and call to Him. This is the God who sent His Son to rescue His people from their sin. This is not just any God. This is the God that we're being called to worship. The only true God. The only real God that we're being called to worship. So to worship Him means to live in such a way that shows He is more valuable than anything else in the world. It's to live in such a way that shows He is more important than anything else in the world. So I think what's really helpful about this kind of clarification for us is it shows us what the goal is of all these rhythms that we've been talking about. The goal of us spending time in the Word on our own and together, the goal of spending time in prayer on our own and together, the goal of us coming to the Lord's table and celebrating the Lord's Supper, the goal of this worship service week after week is not to get God to see us. He already does that. And for those of you that have a relationship with Christ, God is fully in relationship with you. The goal of these rhythms is not to cause God to see us, but to cause us to see Him. He clearly sees us. We don't clearly see Him. So that's why He's saying, ascribe to the Lord these things. Give the Lord glory and strength. Give Him the glory due His name. And as we obey these commands, it's going to show up in two main ways in our lives. It's going to show up in daily worship in all of life. And it's going to show up in weekly worship like this with the people of God. Both of these things. We can't just be people who say, well, I just worship the Lord on Sunday, but on the rest of the week I live like He doesn't exist. But we also can't be like, you know what? I'm just kind of like worshiping the Lord on my own. I don't really need to worship Him with other people. Either one of those extremes pulls us away from where the Bible's trying to pull us here. And what's interesting is, as we think about daily worship, worshiping the Lord at your job, at your school, in the sports that you play, in the things that you're involved in your neighborhood, in your friendships, in your family, worshiping Him in all of those areas because He has given us the good gifts of all of those areas, that daily worship prepares us to gather together with God's people in this weekly worship. And then this weekly worship prepares us to then go back into the week and live out the daily worship. They go together. We need both. The Lord is the Lord of every day. We want to worship Him every day. And these first two verses here in Psalm 29 help us rightly understand what's happening here in this weekly rhythm of worshiping God together with our church. When we come here on Sunday morning, we are not worshiping a feeling. We're not worshiping an experience. We're not worshiping a certain person or a personality. Although all those things are factors. There should be ways that this affects our feelings. We should have experiences of the Lord and His grace as we worship together. We do need people with their personalities to lead us in these things. But none of those things are the object or goal of our worship. We're worshiping the Lord. He's the object. He's the focus of our worship. And what's beautiful about this is this takes the idea of worship higher than just our personal taste and cultural preferences. The way we worship as a church, with our kind of certain way it reflects our culture and who we are as a church, is not the only way to worship the Lord as a church. The songs and the order of service and instruments, they don't have to check all our boxes for worship to take place. So if you show up and you think, man, I'm just not really a big fan of that song, that's okay. Because we're not worshiping any of us. We're worshiping the Lord. Well, I just wish the service was a little, or this was different. That we're all going to have different preferences. We could all have, like, if we wanted to make a worship service that fit all of our boxes, we would need to have as many different worship services as there are people in this room. But we can come together and worship the Lord, because if we're giving God the glory His name deserves, we're worshiping. That's what worship is. But just as important as the who of worship is the why. Why do we do this? Like, week after week, year after year, we do this. We have this gathering. Why? That's the next question. Why do we worship? We're going to get to verses 3 through 9 of Psalm 29 in this part. And as we come to this part, this psalm gets really loud. It gets really loud. Because I think what you see here is it seems to be this word picture of a storm moving from the Mediterranean Sea across the land of Israel. And whether the author, as David is writing this, whether he actually sees a storm or just thinks about God's power and paints the picture for us, the main point is still the same. So let's pick up in verse 3 and you'll see the picture I'm talking about. The voice of the Lord is over the waters. The God of glory thunders. The Lord over many waters. So you see the storm building off the coast of Israel, and you see this first mention of the voice of the Lord. That's going to be repeated over and over in this part too. Pay attention to that. But David is watching the storm, and he's knowing, man, that storm is powerful, but the voice of the Lord is more powerful. We're going to skip verse 4 because we're going to come back to it here at the end. I think it's the big point of this whole section. But let's go down to verse 5. The voice of the Lord breaks the cedars. The Lord breaks the cedars of Lebanon. So the storm has made landfall into the region of Lebanon, and it breaks the cedars. So why is that such a big deal? Well, the cedars of Lebanon were the trees of trees. Even today, on the flag for the country of Lebanon is a cedar tree. Because these were massive, huge, strong trees. But he's saying the voice of the Lord is stronger. The voice of the Lord is more powerful. And then we get to verse 6. He makes Lebanon to skip like a calf and Sirion like a young wild ox. The storm is moving through the land of Israel. And this is in verse 6 is referring to these two mountains, Mount Lebanon and Sirion, also known as Mount Hermon. Maybe some of your translations may say that. But the voice of the Lord is more powerful than the great and impressive mountains of the earth. These are huge, massive structures. But the voice of the Lord is bigger. The voice of the Lord is stronger. And God's presence is more majestic than the presence of these mountains. And then verse 7. The voice of the Lord flashes forth flames of fire. The voice of the Lord shakes the wilderness. The Lord shakes the wilderness of Kadesh. The voice of the Lord makes the deer give birth and strips the forest bare. So the storm has now moved south in Israel, and the voice of God has this great power and this noticeable effect on His creation. And it's wide-ranging. We've gone north, south, east, west, and the Lord's power and voice are over all of it. He's showing us the vastness of God, that there are great and mighty things in the world that He has made, but none of them compare to Him. And I want to go back to verse 4 because I think that's the main truth being illustrated here. He says in verse 4, the voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is full of majesty. He's saying God's voice is unrivaled in its power. God's voice is full of majesty, meaning God rules over all things by His word. Everything that people think is impressive, great storms, giant trees, mighty mountains, powerful people, all of it is under the power of the voice of God of glory. His voice and His power are far stronger and better than any forms of power we see in this world. And when it says the voice of the Lord is powerful, the voice of the Lord is full of majesty, we see these reasons for why we should worship Him. Verses 1 and 2 were kind of a call for us to worship Him. And verses 3 through 9 are saying, all right, now here's why you should worship Him. And He says, we should give Him glory and strength. We should bow down before Him because His power is unsurpassed. There's no one like Him. There's no God like the Lord. But what's interesting is that this powerful voice doesn't stop in the Old Testament. It doesn't stop here in David's experience in Psalm 29. It continues into the New. Because when Jesus came to earth as the God-man, fully God and fully man, He showed His unmatched power through His voice as well. He came into this world, and at one point, He was in a boat with His disciples, and this massive storm, maybe like the one David's describing in Psalm 29, was whipping up on the sea while they were on the boat. His disciples were in a total panic. Jesus says, "Be still." The storm is still. The sea is still. Then another time in Jesus' life, He encounters all these different people that are burdened with various diseases, and he just says with His voice, "Be healed." And they're healed completely. Like no one's been able to heal them or help them. Another time in Jesus' life, one of His friends, Lazarus, dies. And Jesus says the words, "Lazarus, come out." And wouldn't you know it, Lazarus, who was dead, walks out of that grave alive. Jesus didn't touch him. He didn't go in and do anything. He just spoke. And His voice was powerful. And the greatest work of all that Jesus has done, the work to save you and I, He was hanging on a cross looking like someone who was anything but powerful, looking like someone who was anything but victorious. And He cries out, "It is finished." And the souls of all His people have salvation secured forever just by His voice. The universe doesn't exist without the voice of the Lord. Salvation doesn't exist without the voice of the Lord. His church does not exist without His voice. And a powerful voice of this magnitude, it calls for a response. You can't learn of this reality and just sit there unaffected. That's why He says at the end of verse 9, He says, "And in His temple all cry glory." That's ascribing to the Lord the glory due His name. That's ascribing to the Lord glory and strength. In His temple all cry glory. This is the climactic moment of the psalm where we see that worship happens when our voices respond to His voice. Awe and wonder at the greatness of God. This is one of the reasons we have this service, is you and I need reminders of the greatness of God. We through the week, we just lose sight of it at times. And we need to be reminded of how powerful and amazing He is. But His voice, the voice of the Lord, is what starts our worship. His voice is the creator of our worship. Biblical worship happens when we hear God's voice through His word and we respond in worship back to Him. That's what's happening in this room week after week. And that's exactly what we plan for as a pastoral team. That's what we pray for, that we're not coming to respond to a person or something on the platform or any kind of mood. We're coming to respond to the Lord and His word. Our Sunday services and even other ministries in our church are a weekly rhythm of us learning from God through His word and responding in worship. And that worship shows up in many different ways. It can be praising Him, confessing sin to Him, obeying Him, asking him for help and guidance in a situation, learning from him, feeling his presence and his goodness. But it's why every week you hear someone get up here at the beginning of the service and they say something like, the scripture guiding our worship this morning is, then they read it. That's why that happens every week. Because we want the voice of the Lord to guide what we're doing in this room. Not, well, wouldn't it be a good idea if we just did this? Or wouldn't it be cool if we did? We want to be creative and we want to show our personalities. And we want to express who the Lord has made us as a church. But all in response to Him and to His Word. We're not responding to a sound. We're not responding to a musical style. We're not responding to a crescendo or a certain kind of technology. All those things are good and important. But they're not what bring us before God and make us more like Him. They're not more powerful than the voice of the Lord. Only His voice can spark worship in a human heart. Real worship. So our worship doesn't begin when the first note of music is played. Worship begins by the invitation of our God. And His Word is that invitation for us to come and worship Him. This is who God is. This is what He has done. This is what He will do. So we come and we worship Him. What's really helpful about this, though, is that this vertical relationship between us and the Lord and us responding to His voice, it also has a horizontal effect in our relationships with each other. Because our unity in worship is similar to what I said just a few minutes ago. Our unity in worship is not based on all of us liking the same musical style. Our unity in worship is not based on all of us liking the style of the sanctuary. Our unity in worship is not based on all of us agreeing on the right volume level. We're united around God's Word. We're united around the Lord who calls us to worship, who's the only God worthy of worship. And every generation, every culture, every person can respond to His Word. If we only want to sing the songs we like and the styles we like with the people we like and hear Bible verses we like, it's not God's voice we're responding to anymore. It's our voice. That's not true worship. That's false worship. So I think a helpful zoom out question for us right here is, whose voice is the main voice in your life? Whose voice is sparking worship in your life? This connects a little bit to what we looked at in week one of this whole idea of rhythms. When we were talking about the loudest voices in your life are the ones that shape you. Your habits are formed by who you're hearing. Your loves are formed by who you're listening to. So who's that voice for you? Your own voice? The voice of people that you want to fit in with? The voices on social media? The voices on a news network? The voices in a political party? Or the voice of the Lord? Whose voices shape your daily worship? Whose voices shape our weekly worship? One way to learn who you truly worship is noticing which voices are the loudest in your life. For those of you that were in life class this morning, you saw a great illustration of this. In life class, we looked at Daniel chapter 3, where King Nebuchadnezzar builds this huge golden statue, and he wants everyone to worship and bow down to it. So his voice is crying out, here's the decree, I've built this, everyone has to bow down to this when the music plays, and if you don't, you're going to be thrown in the fiery furnace. So the music plays, everyone bows down except three guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Whose voice were they responding to? They're responding to the voice of the Lord, right? Everyone else is responding to the voice of the king. But for them, the loudest voice was not the voice of King Nebuchadnezzar. Their loudest voice was the voice of the Lord as they knew Him through His Word. And their worship was different because of that. And the same call lies on us. So we don't worship with ourselves as God. We don't worship to try to perform for God. It's not what this is. We worship by coming to God through a relationship with Jesus and responding to His Word with faith. Our final question is this: how do we worship? How do we worship? Let's look at the last two verses of Psalm 29 to begin answering this question. I say begin because we'll carry this over into next week as well. Next week we'll kind of wrap up the whole rhythms series for us. But we'll start answering it with Psalm 29 verses 10 and 11. The Lord sits enthroned over the flood. The Lord sits enthroned as king forever. May the Lord give strength to his people. May the Lord bless his people with peace. Verse 10 makes it clear that the Lord is on his throne and no one else can have that seat. He is the King of Kings. It says in the first part of verse 10 that he sits enthroned over the flood. The flood. Talking about the one of Noah's day, Noah and the ark, that flood. The Lord was ruler of the universe in Noah's day when he flooded the earth and saved Noah and his family through the ark. And it says in the second part of verse 10, the Lord sits enthroned as king forever. So he's still ruler of the universe today. He ruled over the universe then, every day since then, and every day after this. He's the ruler. He's the king. His voice is the most powerful and majestic voice there is. His power and his control are permanent. They don't ebb and flow. They don't come and go. They don't waver. And when we begin to grasp the main truth of this, we have no other option but to give him the glory due his name. To recognize he's the king and we are not. To recognize he rules and we don't. To recognize he deserves worship and we're the ones called to give him that worship. And I think the last verse of the psalm shows us the impact of knowing these truths about God and responding in this weekly rhythm. Verse 11 says this, may the Lord give strength to his people. May the Lord bless his people with peace. This is the point where the psalm moves from heaven to earth, where it goes from these big thoughts about God, and it shows how these big truths about God are at work among his people. God is powerful and almighty, but he's also closely involved with his people. He's not distant from us. He's near to us. He's always with us. One pastor explained it by doing a contrast this way in this psalm. He said, the God of glory is a God of grace. The God of majesty is a God of mercy. The God of power is a God of peace. Lord is his covenant name, and his people are his covenant people. So this tells us that when it comes to worship, God didn't create us to only worship on our own, but together with his family, with others who know him and call on him as their God and their king. And again, more on this next week, but the takeaway for now is that each Christian's relationship with God is personal, but no one has a relationship with God that's meant to be private. All of us are meant to have a personal, individual relationship with God, but a relationship with God that exists around other people that have that same relationship with God. And there's no substitute for a weekly gathering with a local church to respond to God and his word together in worship. And some of you that are watching right now at home, you are physically unable to be in this kind of gathering. So when you hear me say those words, you don't need to have some kind of unnecessary guilt. The Lord knows and understands, and he values the way you're worshiping with us by watching online. But when he says here in verse 11, may the Lord give strength to his people, may the Lord bless his people with peace, one of the main sources of God's strength and peace for his people is this weekly gathering. When we gather together week after week, sitting under his rule, by sitting under his word together and be reminded of who he is, what he's done, and what he will do, and how we should respond to all of that. Privilege we have to step into this gathering each week and experience this rhythm where heaven and earth meet, this rhythm where God invites us to join in with the heavenly beings and with generations of Christians from every language and every nation as we bow down and worship to the Lord, the God of glory, the only God whose name deserves this kind of glory. And the more we see this rhythm as a privilege, the more it becomes a priority in our lives. To worship God rightly, we need something more than just some simple how-to presentation. We need a view of God that is bigger than our personal preferences. We need a view of God that is bigger than our cultural traditions. We need a view of God that is bigger than our understanding of church, however we've been taught it growing up. So who do we worship? We worship the Lord, the great I Am, the majestic and powerful God. Why do we worship? To put it simply, we worship because He has spoken. Because He's a God who speaks. And in this weekly rhythm, our voices are not saying the first word. Worship is a rhythm of seeing God through the Bible and praising Him for what we see there. And how do we worship? Daily worship that I talked about earlier, that is crucial, of course. But there's no replacement for God's people worshiping Him together in person. We gain strength and peace and joy and faith as we rub elbows with other believers and sit under His Word together. So as we worship this morning, we're not responding to the songs, we're not responding to the music, we're not responding to the leaders, although all those things are vital and crucial to what's happening in here. We're responding to God. We're responding to the One who speaks. We're responding to the God of glory, the One who sits enthroned as King forever. So let's give Him the glory due His name. Let's pray.